Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson. Well, 2016 certainly got off to a rocky start, at least for the paper bulls out there. Equity markets got off to a very bad start, in some cases, their worst first week of trading ever, as was the case for U.S. equity markets. And for everyone following our work, you know that we believe the perpetual expansion of financial assets was just another bubble in search of a pin. Now, has that pin been found, or will there be another rescue or sets of rescues engineered by the central banks? Who knows? But we do know that it would be a mistake to pretend as if you've got all the time in the world, or to assume that a tiny group of appointed individuals that mainly serve the interests of their major client banks are omnipotent and all capable, or that they care about you and your family, your community, even your country in the slightest. So as we kick off 2016, who better to talk to than David Morgan, a precious metals aficionado with degrees in finance, economics, and engineering? He created the silverinvestor.com website, which is in the process, I understand, of becoming themorganreport.com. And he is the publisher of The Morgan Report, a monthly newsletter that covers economic news, overall financial health of the global economy, currency problems, and the key reasons for investing in precious metals. We'll be talking to David about money, sound money, silver, and the many other important things each of us might do to prepare for what is obviously going to be a very different and turbulent future. Welcome, David.
Well, thank you, Chris. It's great to be with you.
Well, let's start with the markets. You follow macroeconomics. You follow the markets very closely. That was a rough first week. Now, was that a blip, David, or is that the start of a very long overdue correction?
Well, I'll pull a Janet Yellen on you, Chris. I need more data. I'll say that. And I actually am being sincere.
Yeah.
It certainly was a bad start and abnormal, meaning, as you said, the biggest drop probably since we've been recording these things. Additionally, of course, it's the China syndrome, I call it. China is basically the huge exporter to the world, and they're really having problems internally. And, of course, as we know about the Baltic Dry Index, which I'm sure we'll get to, all signs, all the objectivity that we can muster points that not only are we slowing down, we're probably going through the R and into the D, meaning we're really in a recession and probably heading toward the depression or maybe touching the depression, depending on how you define it. But it is worrisome. And one thing I want to start with is a bit positive. I mean, a lot of people have a misconception or connotation about a crisis, a collapse, a monetary failure. And it's this, and this is from the feedback that I've received. This is my opinion, but it's a strong one. They have the idea like everything ceases, and it's not the case. People have a financial survival instinct, a survival instinct, and things do not stop or go to zero. However, there are huge dislocations. There are huge readjustments. There are areas of extreme strife and that type of thing, but it isn't as if everything just stops. I want to make that clear in a quote-unquote normal, and there's no such thing as a normal financial or currency crisis, there's a reallocation of assets, meaning that bad malinvestment is taken out of the market, and things that we really need, really want, and the market says, you know, that's viable, continue on. But that process takes time. And it's my opinion, again, that it's going to take much more time this time around versus, let's say, the 1930s, because it's a global basis. We're all tied together. There's so much interdependency. There's so much extra specialization. There's not enough diversification in some areas. Take the banking sector as an example. Rather than being diversified and strong or resilient, as you put in the book, it's not resilient. It's very fragile. And that's the tendency that's been taking place, even though there's more people on the planet. The tendency has been going to be, I'll call it anti-resilient. It's more fragile.
More fragile. And I think a key word you said in there is this interconnectedness, which I think has got some benefits while everything's going smoothly, but let's talk about the risks of this. So here we are, we're recording this. It's Monday. It's the 11th. It's after a, you know, we had that bad week, some very obvious overnight rescue attempts by the Chinese government, particularly a yuan intervention to prop that currency up. And U.S. futures in the overnight went from 10 down to 10 up, a 20-point swing in the S&P, based on what Chinese monetary authorities were doing at the margin on their currency. That's how interconnected things are. That's how I see it. Is that an inappropriate conclusion to draw, that overnight decisions by Chinese at the margin of their currency market have impacts now on equity markets? And if so, why should the price of the stock of General Motors have anything to do with a minor wiggle in the yuan?
Well, great question. First of all, yes. I mean, we've gotten to the point, in my view, where, you know, if I can step back and digress into a comic movie with Rodney Dangerfield, I think it was Caddyshack, and it shows him with a cell phone before they existed on his golf bag. And, you know, he gets a call from his broker and he says, everybody's buy and sell. Gets a call back, everybody's selling buy. I mean, it's as if these financial markets are so volatile and there's no real direction that, as you said, Chris, just a currency move will cause GM to go up. And this is ridiculous. There's no reason for that in any way, shape, or form. And yet this is the way the markets are acting. So the point is, succinctly, there's no reality to these markets at this point in time. I've been saying for months now that in a normal market, the stock market reflects pretty much the physical economy. So if you have a good idea and a good business and, you know, you're an entrepreneur and you create something the market wants, the market's going to vote, your share price is going to go up, there's going to be more demand, and you're going to see that in the market price of the equity. And does that take place today? Of course. Let me say it isn't in all cases. But generally speaking, from the broad brush point of view, it's absolutely disconnected from reality. So you're seeing these moves, and it's a point where, for those that are as old as I am, there used to be a gentleman named, he's deceased now, but Elliot Janeway. And Janeway was sort of a maverick type economist, and he said, you know, the end is nigh when you and I are sitting across a table from each other and we're both trying to sell each other life insurance policies. In other words, when all we've done is this financial manipulation to the point where all we have is a thought. In other words, a life insurance policy is based on a financial instrument that pays off at some point, but it's just the extension of the financial markets, which we've seen huge growth in the financial industry, but it's based on a lot of quantitative quants, these mathematicians that make up these derivatives and on and on. I don't want to go too far down the rabbit hole, Chris, you can bring me back, but the idea is that this produces absolutely nothing in the financial economy at all, and yet the talking heads constantly point to it and say, look, 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 things are fine, they are fine, they're fine. If you have a deep understanding of it, the more you see the financial instruments increase, the more you know we're in trouble. That's my point.
If this gentleman had been alive later on, David, he would have been talking about derivatives, because honestly, a life insurance policy is a derivative and the underlying asset is your life, right? So if he had been, you know, really looking at what we see in the derivative markets, not to follow you down that rabbit hole too far, but derivatives are fundamentally at the heart of a lot of what I think is really going to go wrong, because, you know, you've been talking about the unreality of these markets. They've disconnected from fundamentals. So the price is now disconnected from reality. Derivatives allow us to go even one step further over into avalanche territory, one step further out on the cornice by, I think, allowing risk to be not just mispriced, but to give the wrong and false illusion that risk has been somehow banished. And of course, this was Greenspan's, he loved derivatives. And he said, oh my gosh, these things are fantastic. They allow people to manage and mitigate risk. And he really, I think, hint, hint, wink, wink, thought that they made risk go away. I have sort of a second law of thermodynamics of rule of risk, which is you can't make it go away. You can only transform it. So the derivatives have spread the risk a little bit. But as we found out in the housing crisis with the collateralized debt obligations on the housing stuff, it didn't make the risk go away. A bad decision is a bad decision. Malinvestment is malinvestment. You can paper over it all you want. It doesn't really help you underneath at all. So I'd like to get your comments on really how you manage to think about derivatives in this world, knowing that nobody, do you know anybody that actually knows really what, how they, not just what an individual one is, but how they're going to behave in total in a crisis?
Well, awesome question. I'll give you my opinion on that because I can't cite facts exactly. I can give a little bit of history. I think it was Anglo Ashanti back in the start of the bull market blew up based on their derivative book, and the derivatives were so complicated that they had to get the quants and the mathematicians to find out who was owed what, because these things were very, very difficult because of the math involved. And it's an idea that Jim Rickards talks about, and I'll talk about it more. I'm certainly not trying to talk over anyone's head here, and it's maybe difficult on the radio, maybe not. But we all kind of know what the bell curve looks like. And, you know, in the middle, you get the most, common situation, whereas at the tail end, either at the front or the back end, it trails off to almost zero. So that's called the tail end of the curve. I think most people can picture that in their heads. And so the idea that Greenspan and others have said is we're working in the tail end of the curve, and because of that, the risk is almost zero. I mean, and this is basically preposterous based on the assumption that, one, you can predict human behavior. Mm-hmm. The best example of that is long-term capital management. Long-term capital management was run by people that were Nobel laureates, that won the Nobel Prize. They were very smart. There's no doubt about that. And they felt that their software, their program, could predict human behavior. And you know what? You can predict human behavior some of the time, but not all of the time. So when they went into the Russian ruble and it was so many orders of magnitude off of what their math program said, it meant that the risk was certain to come back, and I put certain in quotation marks, and therefore they continue with the trade, and guess what? That's not what happened, because you can't predict human behavior all the time. And so it blew up long-term capital management. This is one of those shots across the bow that the Wall Street establishment had right in their face. And of course, did they learn from it? The answer is no, not at all. The Fed came in and rescued everybody, and the game goes on. So that's an example. So now I want to give the example of an asymptotic curve. Asymptotic is just a fancy word that means if you get to that tail end, so if you picture a bell curve, when it starts to get very low toward the x-axis, that line is parallel to the x-axis. So what it means is the further you go out in time, the risk stays the same. No matter how much time or no matter how many derivatives you put on it, the risk is a constant risk. That's asymptotic. That means that it's parallel. I think I got my math right on this, mm-hmm. Chris. And the idea is that this delta hedging, where if you've made a bad bet in a commodity, and you have infinite money, which the banks do, then what you do is you keep loading up one side so that you almost force the market to go the direction that you want. But I want to give a very clear example. This comes from gaming theory, and I think this is a very clear, concise, and easy way for most people to understand it. There's all kinds of gambling programs out there, but one of the simplest ones before any computers was if you're at the blackjack table, or you could be wherever, but blackjack serves the best analogy, and you bet $1 and you lose. Then the next bet, you bet $2 and you lose. And then the next bet, you bet $4 and you lose. And the next bet, you bet $8 and you lose. The idea is that eventually, you're going to keep betting black, and eventually that is going to come up and you are going to win on the roulette table. The problem with that is this. You start to bet 32, 64, 128, 256, and on, and now what you're doing is you're betting like $256 for what? To win a dollar. That's what you're doing. And that, Chris, I think is the best example I can give to the listeners about what we are doing in these derivatives. This is based on the simplified thing, which was delta hedging, which is fairly easy to understand. But now you've got these mathematicians out there writing these derivatives that make the example I just gave you look like child's play, and that's literally a fact. And these things are so interdependent, and there's so much counterparty risk, and that's, of course, the biggest issue, is if you win the bet in the derivatives market, what happens if the counterparty can't pay you? And that's what happened in 2008. And people still don't realize how close we were to the edge at that point, because banks were not trusting each other and they were not trusting each other's paper. So they weren't trusting their counterparty. And what happened was the Fed came in and said, well, Bank A, you don't trust Bank B's paper. Bank B, you don't trust Bank A's paper. Here's what we're going to do. I'll take your paper, meaning the Fed's taking these worthless mortgages, and saying, we'll settle T-bills. You like those things, don't you? And the answer is, oh, of course. Well, what's better than a T-bill? So then they settled out. And, of course, this is where this whole expansion of the Fed's balance sheet has taken place over the last several years, because now everybody's happy because you have paper you can trust. What happens when you don't trust government paper? And, Chris, that's really what's happening now, because if you look at the foreign markets, what's been going on in the U.S. dollars, they've basically been dumping the dollar, and the Exchange Stabilization Fund has come in and sopped it up, so it's not transparent to the markets unless you really know how to dig deep. But we are, in my view, in a place I've written about in the early 2000s, a place where the world has never been. We are on the precipice of a situation that is global in scope and is going to probably affect, for all practical purposes, almost everybody on the planet.
And that is what's different this time. Dangerous words always in investing, but what's different is there's nowhere really to run, right? You know, David, I get this question from people like, oh, maybe I'll go to another country. And I look at this and I go, I don't see anywhere to really hide this time, unless you're going to hang out with like a Stone Age tribe somewhere, or, you know, you're going to just hang with the Amish and they've got a well-defended perimeter or whatever. You know, you've got this situation where at least if you were in Weimar Germany or you're in Zimbabwe in the 90s or in Yugoslavia in the 80s, you know, you could always go across a border and you could hide out somewhere. And where do you hide out today? Well, you know, as we mentioned, this is not just an interlinked, but it's a globally interlinked world. All the markets are tied together. And I don't see anywhere to particularly hang out. Now, this thing about the derivatives is very important because, you know, the magic word in there is the counterparty risk. Aside from all the, you know, unfathomable complexity of these things, it's not just individually, but interlinked, the unfathomable complexity, because I might do a bad justice to explaining this, but I think about it like let's say you're a hedge fund, David, and you decided you're going to invest in Greek bonds because that makes a lot of sense to you, but you're worried that they might default on them or something like that, and so you buy a credit default swap from me, and I'll pay you if your bonds go bad. Now, because you're covered, you're like, well, I've got this bet. It either goes up or I'm covered, so now I can actually take on more leverage and take on another bet. So you take on another bet with another counterparty, and so on and so forth. And if I can't pay you, it's not just a simple matter of you going, ah, shucks, I lost my, you know, the $10 million of coverage I thought I was going to have with Chris. It's that all of a sudden, because I couldn't pay you, you can't pay the next person who, you know, you were hedged out in an opposite direction with, all just trying to skim a little off the top. That's the best I understand this, which it isn't just a simple matter of derivatives ultimately are a zero-sum game. That's true. But everybody's taken on extra leverage and assumed that they were risk-free on the basis of owning these things. And so when you have badly priced risk and extra leverage, come on, haven't we seen this story written out before?
Yes, we have, but not to this level. And you're right. I mean, a common sense approach is, you know, the collapse of complex societies, the general idea being that the more complicated a system is, the more points of failure that exist. And you've never had more points of failure in the financial system than you have now, because these derivatives become so ubiquitous. They're everywhere and they're so interconnected. So, you know, you might have Bank A and Bank B just fine, but then they find out after they study what their risk exposure is that there was something dependent on some obscure bank somewhere that's failed, and then they can't pay and it goes down, you know, goes down the line, meaning that it topples. It's the one domino hitting two, hitting four, hitting eight. The analogy close to the one I gave on gaming theory, where all of a sudden just one little miscue can take out the entire system. That's maybe a bit of an exaggeration, but the idea is clear. These problems are not understood very well by the market. In fact, the belief is it's the opposite. The belief is that they are risk-free or nearly so. And whenever you look in the human realm and you think that you've got it figured out, you better look again.
Well, well said. So this is why, when I ask this next question, we have a very active conversation going on at the site, and people have a wide range of opinions, and they all, I have to hold that they all equally have the same chance of outcome. Some people are relatively convinced that there's a chance for this correction to really get out of hand and to really shut things down. And then there's another group of people that believe, hey, we get corrections, life goes on. And somewhere in between those two extremes, I think, is reality is somewhere in there. What we've been talking about with derivatives has the capability of literally shutting down the banking system for a period of time while we try and sort all this out. And that this is exclusive of any geopolitical event or war with Russia or an EMP or some, real game changer like that. But just within the construct of how overextended, how overleveraged, how over indebted our system is, this reset could be pretty bad, couldn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's going to go down the historical record books. It'll be a monumental point in history, and it'll be absolutely a new point in the financial record, because there's nothing like this that's existed on the planet before. And, I think it was Doug Casey years ago wrote it, and I agree with him. I think when this thing all comes to a head and falls down and it's resurrected at some point, I think that you'll see basic derivatives basically outlawed or something close to that. I want to give the correct idea. I don't know exactly how it's going to go, but we will see the problem after the fall, not before the fall. Some of us will see it before the fall, but most won't. And after it takes place, then they'll say, oh, I see what happened is we got way too leveraged. Derivatives were a bad idea. We cannot make derivatives anymore. And of course, that will go for some time, just like a fiat money scheme. And then, of course, someone will say, well, we really need some derivatives because we need to be able to hedge our, risk, and then it'll start all over again, most likely. And I base that on human nature. But I think that is what will take place, Chris, is that we will see both of the events go into the historical record book, because we've never experienced this. I mean, we've seen subsets, as you said, Wymer or Zimbabwe, and it doesn't necessarily mean hyperinflation. In fact, I don't think we'll see a hyperinflation. I think we'll see enough of a distrust of the U.S. dollar and maybe the equity market simultaneously. So if you saw the bond and stock market sell off together, it doesn't have to be at a hyperinflation rate. It just happens to be enough of a distrust or a loss of confidence is a better way to state it. So when the loss of confidence takes place at a great enough level, that's when it's game over, as far as I'm concerned.
And that plays right into a lot of the advice I've been both giving and living by for a while, which is that loss of trust ultimately comes with, I think, a revelation where people start to see reality a little bit more clearly. And one of the big distortions that sits out there as well is, I think, the degree to which people have confused price with value. And so I don't think there's going to be any way to avoid what's coming next. I think there are ways to evade it a little bit. So the difference between avoid and evade. To me, my evasion tactics include hiding out in real assets. Gold and silver have been favorites of mine. Real estate, owning my home outright, making productive investments in my energy production and efficiency in my own house, beginning to invest more in companies that have real defined products that I can understand and believe in. That's been sort of my approach so far. But of course, it's been a tough number of years because the prices of things, in particular, all commodities, but I hate to put gold as a commodity, but that's where it sort of gets talked about. But the whole commodity complex has just been under assault since 2011. Massive wipeouts coming across the agricultural, mining, precious metal spaces, energy as well. Obviously, coal companies going out of business almost weekly now at this point in time. Oh my gosh, I'm looking at oil. It's at $31.75 on my screen right now. Yikes. So around all of that, how do you think that this idea of investing in real assets is going to play out in what I consider to be real value, because value is stuff that you can touch, eat, use, feel, smell. I mean, it's like the real things in life. As we've seen it play out, though, you know, the real things have just been, in terms of price, have been getting killed. How do you read that? And do you think that, you know, you would modify a strategy that would mean maybe you hide out in dollars for a lot longer and wait for things to get cheaper? Or is that a bad strategy because, boy, you're taking a risk because nobody knows when things are going to finally turn? Or how do you cope with this really bizarre environment?
Oh, great question. First of all, I concur with you for the most part, but I'm glad you added on the dollar part because I want to address that. But yeah, I think the most important thing is to get a real grip on reality. And I think our society, especially in the West, reflects the non-reality that we're all living in. I mean, the idea of an iPhone, and I certainly have one and probably use it more than I need to, but this virtual reality that we're all living in with the computers and all that is a good reflection of basically the derivatives market. And I don't want to overstate the derivative case. But the point being is you need to be, first of all, real with yourself. I mean, you know, going to your book, Prosper, and how to prepare for the future and create a world worth inheriting. And I'm glad you added that part because, you know, I have two daughters, and one of the big things to wake me up from being kind of a low-key, non-transparent consultant for the financial markets to out with the website and talking and doing interviews like this where, you know, it's available for almost everyone if they care to listen, is because of my daughter. When she was born, I thought, you know what, I didn't want her to be, you know, 18 and say, well, Dad, if you knew so much, how come you didn't do anything about it? And I know talking is just talking, but okay, let's go to the reality. Well, I live on a property that has 5 acres. I've grown my own food for years. I have a hand pump on my well. I have a septic system. I have some solar, very minimal, but I have it. And the idea is that I am more self-sufficient than most people, because I too, Chris, think that you need real things. And that's, of course, the commodity markets, and they've been creamed here in the last several years, which is reality. I mean, it's not whether we want them to be this or that. It is what it is. Primarily, I think the reason is that the world's broke. There's just been too much, again, in the financial markets and not enough in the physical economy. The China boom, the industrial revolution, if you will, that took place in the early 2000s has run out of steam, and it's not that they can't produce. In fact, they're at a productive capacity greater than what they need or the world needs. It's just that there aren't buyers on the other side. The American middle class has been pretty much wiped out for the most part. So people, generally speaking, are, if they have money, they're holding on to it. If they, great majority don't really have any disposable income. They're just getting by. So we're in this pushing on a string mode, you know, the deflation argument where there's capacity to make stuff, but there's no demand. And oil is a good example of the overall global economy. So on the U.S. dollar part, it's always good really to have cash, no matter what the form, until it blows up, because it gives you, you know, what's liquidity. And the reason I have been strong on a fairly decent cash position is not me. It's someone better than me, John Exter, that did the upside down pyramid. And I was one of the first, to my knowledge, in fact, I'll take credit for it, to bring forth his work into our community, meaning the, you know, hard asset, real look at the economic environment. And the upside down pyramid is a liquidity pyramid. Derivatives really didn't exist when John made the upside down pyramid. But what it shows is people go towards safety. And the safest thing for 99% of the population is a dollar. It's a physical piece of paper. I'm talking about greenbacks. And that's at the very bottom of the pyramid, save one other asset class, and that's gold. So anything tied to the dollar will deteriorate, meaning like the stock market, the bond market, everything else, derivatives especially. So the worse an investment is, like subprime mortgage as an example, we've already seen this through 2008 and onward, those things go to the buy and buy. They get sold off, and of course the buyer of last resort's pretty much been the Fed. But those are at the base of the pyramid, which remember is upside down. So as we work toward things we trust, we have more confidence in, it moves down to the dollar. So the dollar will be like the big guy on the block just before the world, the economy, a nation state, a hedge fund manager, who knows where it'll start, where the flame will catch. And at that point, there's a distrust of the dollar, and then we get to run the gold. So the idea is, if you look closely at where we are now in the scheme of things, I could build a very strong case that this thing is playing out exactly or very close to what Exter predicted, and I agree with, is that it looks bleak for us in the precious metals community because the dollar is so strong. But no, that's because everyone's trusting the dollar. They want short-term instruments. They don't want to lend their money long. They're not sure about the equity market, so they go to cash. And so that will probably continue to push the dollar higher, even though the smart money, meaning some of the nation states, et cetera, like China, Russia, India, have been moving out of the dollar and into gold for a long time. And they've started, let's not say a run to gold. They've been walking into the gold space quietly and unobserved by most of the population of the planet. But nonetheless, they've been doing it, and they do it as a professional. They accumulate slowly over time as to not rock the markets or move the price. But it doesn't take much more for that little walk to turn into a jog, to turn into a full out run, turn into a sprint. And then we've got to run the gold because the dollar isn't trusted by more than don't trust it now, which, if I can go on and maybe belabor it, you know, we've seen this over the last several years where the BRICS have come to the fore. They have a competing block of nation states. They have the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. They have a system of electronic settlement that competes with the SWIFT system. So they're definitely trying to move away from the dollar in a very large way that if the dollar fails, perhaps they can remain standing. Personally, I doubt it. I think too much is tied to the dollar for them to come out the other side whole, but it might help them at some level. So we are, again, in a situation, if you truly understand it, you have to get grounded. You have to get your emotions under control. You have to realize that financial collapse or currency crisis or whatever and however it manifests isn't the end of the world, but it's large disruptions. So be grounded and be prepared for it. And that goes back to your personal reality, which is, again, why I like the fact that you wrote the book, because you have to look into what you can control. And one of the things, of course, as you talk about, is your physical health. I mean, we have gotten so far away from value. I want to come back to what you said about price and value. You know, the idea in the West primarily is that a person's life is priceless. You cannot put a dollar amount on a human being. It's unbelievably priceless. Yet, how many of us really live our lives with that thought in mind, or at least in our consciousness, let's say even on a weekly basis? Mm-hmm. But it's true. And so if you value life, you certainly should value your own, and you should be of value to others. Are you adding value when you're writing, you know, these derivatives contracts? I mean, I'm not trying to pick on the derivatives, but the idea is that you really need to get settled in and look at what you need versus what you want. The pendulum has swung so far in the stuff that we don't need. I mean, do I need an iPhone? I could build a case, I probably do, but I certainly had a decent life without it. And so we need to get back to basics. And I think the markets are going to force us to get back to basics, because we're going to be in a world where, for example, if you go back to when I was a young man, if you walked into a grocery store when I was in my late teens or early 20s, the idea that you could buy any kind of grape any time of year was preposterous. You got them when they were in season, and that was it. But now with this global empire, it's very nice to be able to buy, you know, Concord grapes from Mexico in the middle of the winter time. It's wonderful. But that may cease, because as things contract and the reality shines through, those type of situations may break down. In fact, I'm almost certain that they will.
I certainly agree. And even if they don't, the risk is high enough that people ought to consider it, even if it's just to weigh that possibility and discard it. I know many people who haven't even taken that first part of that thought process. So absolutely agree. And I'm very excited to come out and talk with you and whoever else wants to attend this seminar and workshop out there in Las Vegas. If we could talk about that for a bit, because now that you opened up the whole idea of health and all of this, it's a very central thesis. You know, David, after studying this, I started all of this because economics is where I started. Then I understood energy a little more. And then the environment comes in. I got that larger picture. But when I first started all of this, there was really, for myself, a strong sense of thinking like I was going to be able to, or I needed to figure out how to control everything. You know, like how could I like get a storage shed full of everything that I would miss if these global chains broke down? And over time, of course, that this matured and has become a circumstance where I understand there's a lot of things I can't control. So letting go of those has been very helpful. But really being very clear and doubling down on the things that I can control. And then thirdly, coming into this view that it's like, ooh, it's not just about making things safe for me, my family. It's really about creating this world worth inheriting. Because let me just put my cards on the table. The direction humanity is heading in right now is going to leave behind a really terrible, destroyed world. You know, just simple things like the fact that almost every major African megafauna animal that exists in a child's storybook right now will be fiction or, you know, an extinct history in just 20 years at this current rate. That's wrong. That's just not even, I mean, it's just, to me, you know, life isn't worth living to survive in. This is a beautiful world and we have the capability to make of it what we want. And I think that starts with, as you mentioned, it starts with our own health and our own bodies. I mean, that's certainly something very much under your control, and it's a good place to start. But I'm very excited to start talking about the solution space, because I got to be honest with you, I'm a little bit tired because I'm in the cat seat, you know, on this. This is what I do every day, is I really catalog what's going wrong, and I really need to be putting more of my time into what we can do on the other side of that spectrum on solutions. So let's talk about this upcoming event in Las Vegas and the Las Vegas Solutions Conference on February 22nd. That's 2016, not that far away. So in your words, what's it going to be about, and who will be there as presenters besides yourself, myself, and Adam Taggart?
Okay, well, thank you for that. Yeah, I've been in the same space, meaning that for the last, I guess, year or two, I've thought, geez, you know, all I've been doing is focusing on the problem. I really want to focus on the solution. And I was asked to speak in Kalispell, Montana, and I was asked, I drove over there, and I did my presentation. But before the presentation, I took a couple extra days and went through the national park, and I met this gentleman that was introduced to me named Rich Sheban. And Rich lives totally off-grid in Montana. And he used to be a pharmaceutical rep. So he's certain from New York. So you don't get much more cityfied than a New York human being that's driving, you know, thousands of miles every month as a pharmaceutical rep for one of the big pharmaceutical houses. And yet this guy's living off grid. So I drove out there. It was a little hard to find this place. And, you know, I always try to stay open-minded, Chris, and not have any predisposed ideas about anything, but it's hard to do. And I didn't have a very vague picture, but I kind of expected sort of a mountain man kind of thing, you know, and this is just my, you know, what's going on in my head. So he comes out, he's dressed better than me, and I'm dressed in jeans and a shirt and a jacket, I mean, you know, but he's, you know, in khakis and a dress shirt. he's a pharmaceutical rep. That's what he looks like, right? And he's been living off grid for a number of years, and he took me through the whole acreage that he has there. I mean, we didn't walk all 20 acres, but we saw what he does outdoors for growing food, what he does in his greenhouse, and the kind of lifestyle he has. And I really felt grounded. We had lunch with him, he and his girlfriend. And he was actually pushing me a little bit to start doing some conferences on the solutions. And I, like you, Chris, and I'm speaking for you, which makes a presupposition, but, you know, on a lot of this stuff, I'm sort of in the middle. I mean, there's people that say, you know, the gold market is manipulated, and there's people that say it isn't, and I'm saying, yes, it is, but I'm sort of in the middle. It's not like as extreme as some people think or advertise, and, you know, there's some misunderstanding about it, but nonetheless, so Rich would be someone that would be at the extreme. He's basically totally off-grid, has a great lifestyle. And then there's people that are like in the middle of an apartment in downtown Vancouver, which would be, I'd say, the opposite end of the spectrum. And where I'm sitting is near a small major city, Spokane, Washington, as I said, 5 acres. So I'm sort of like, I'm not off grid, but if the grid went down, I still have water. I can still flush my toilets. I wouldn't have any sewage problems because I'm on a septic, all that stuff. So, and I have some solar that I could use as a backup, but I'm certainly tied to the grid. So in other words, I'm trying to make the case that I'm kind of in the middle. And that's what I like to do with my thinking. You know, with my engineering degree, you look at everything from zero to infinity. So if you integrate a forcing function, as an example, you look when it's at rest and you look when it's at infinity or toward it approaching, when bending the wing so many times will make it break, as an example. So if you look at that type of approach, which is what I was trained as an engineer, what you're going to find is somewhere in the middle between that zero and infinity lies what we'll call the sweet spot, or where most of the data is, or the bell curve, however you want to think of it. And that's pretty much how I align my life. Now, I'm certainly extreme to the mainstream, but that doesn't mean I'm wrong. All it means is that, I excuse the ego, but they aren't awakened enough to the point of monetary history where it really goes on in these complex situations. So that's what we're shooting for, Chris, is we'll have Rich Sheban will be speaking. We'll have Greg Mannarino. Greg's whole premise is basically that you want to become your own bank. You want to beat the bankers at their own game. He's very good at trading. He has some great advice. It's all for free, and he'll be speaking for at our conference. And then we have Robert Ian, who's helping me put everything together logistically. And Robert has a website called Conquer Change. And Robert has a great, strong message, because the one thing that we all know for a fact is that change is becoming more and more pervasive through our daily lives, and it's happening at a more and more rapid pace. So how do you cope with that? So it hits more on the emotional side that you wrote about in Prosper, where you can stay grounded. And it intersects other areas, like, you know, what do you have control of? Obviously, your physical health, the way you think of others, your social capital, and these type of things. So it's a great lecture that I think everyone will benefit from. So we basically have you and Adam to be our keynotes to kind of lay the groundwork. I think a brief review of the problem so everyone has an understanding. And then, of course, there's always these questions that come up. Well, technology will save us, or don't you know that there's this free energy system that's going to, you know, take over the planet? And you know what? I'm not going to rule that out. It's just that the powers that be, I mean, I don't want to go too far down that path, but to get from here to there is going to be difficult. It's like, you know, labor pains. It's even if the other side has all these wonderful things, nanotechnology, and be able to create more things from human ingenuity, and I don't discount that too heavily. What I'm trying to be realistic about is you don't get there in a straight line. It's going to be very, very difficult for some period of time. And that's what I think the purpose is to help people see the future can be very bright. It can be our creation. We do have a lot to do with it, but we are going to have to pay for our past sins, if you will. And that is why I think it's so important to create this message that let's not just focus on money alone or real money, because that alone will not save you. And that's been kind of the idea in the West. You know, financial freedom is all about, well, if I've got enough money, I can do whatever I want. That might have held true in the 80s and 90s, but it doesn't hold true now. And because of this reality, we need to address what's exactly happening right now and how people can best prepare for it. And again, I compliment you, because I really wanted this to be very impactful. Hopefully it'll catch some traction. I think if it does, I think people really want this, that maybe we can take this further. That depends on the free market. If I'm as a free market advocate as I announced, then the market's going to tell us whether this is a good idea or not. But thank you for coming. Thank you for being the keynote. And I'm really looking forward to it.
I am too. And of course, you say, you know, we have to pay for our past sins. So naturally, we should hold this at Sin City. It's a perfect location. And I'm really looking forward to Las Vegas is a great place. So for anybody listening, you know, if you wanted to come, you know, one of the chief complaints, which is totally valid, is I often hold seminars in very hard to get to places. Las Vegas is not one of those. It's very easy to get to. And February is a good time if you're from one of the colder places like I am to escape out there. So anybody listening, feel free to come, because, you know, David, you could get the best lineup of people and, you know, just have all the best presenters in the world. What I have found with Adam is that when people who share this mindset of understanding where the world is and then wanting to do something about it, when they get together, magic happens all by itself. You could have the worst presenters in the world and it'll still be a great conference for these people because they look around, they don't feel crazy, they're not alone, and they see a lot of other very successful individuals. Typically, these are very successful people who come because these are people who are curious, they figured the world out, they got to this place because they were already investigating things, which means they probably were doing that in the rest of their life professionally as well. So, you know, we find a lot of, you're an engineer, so we find a lot of doctors, lawyers, engineers, people who've been trained in numerate and or logical sort of professions. Those are a lot of people that come, and of course, other people as well, whomever. So that's my big plug is listen, regardless of who's talking, if you come, you're going to have a great time just meeting the other people. And that's really one of a larger value propositions. That's sort of hard to scratch out on a piece of paper and tell people about, but it really is true.
And the synergy too. I mean, because an idea that you throw out, I might talk about in my lecture. And then at the end, there's going to be like a roundup where everybody has the opportunity to meet with each individual speaker and ask their own personal question. So really, we're trying to make this as valuable for the attendees as humanly possible. We want people to come out and get that feeling of like, you know what, no matter what happens, I have got this kind of control and I feel so much better. And it's not more than a feeling. You have to put this stuff into action. But when you give the ability for people to kind of maybe rethink or reevaluate where they are, you know, there's a point in time or a maturity, excuse me, that you get to, that you really get to go introspective and ask the question we all ask, you know, what's it all about? What's mm-hmm. my purpose in life? Mm-hmm. What am I doing here? And my answer has been, I want to be of maximum value to others. And how do you do that? Well, I think you do that by speaking the truth. And this is part of the movement that you and I are in. I mean, some people refer to it as the truth movement. I don't really care what label you put on it, and I'm not a big fan of labels. But what I am a fan of is the human experience. So when I wrote the book, The Silver Manifesto, I spent a great deal of time with Chris Marchese on all kinds of things that deal with the financial markets, economics, the manipulations, and on and on. But the last chapter I wrote was Beyond Silver. And I said, before moving beyond the silver market, it's perhaps best to inform the reader that there's a very high probability that the best lies ahead for silver investors. And I went on to explain that. But I said further that there's more to life than the financial markets, and we have to get back to our human roots. And I quoted three different really deep thinkers about where society may go in the future. And so this isn't David Morgan's look at where we should be going in the future, or could be going is a better word. It's some of these, and I don't adhere to any of them exactly, but I put it out there to get critical thinking because, again, we can create a great deal, and all we need to do is start speaking the truth to each other. And Chris, I'll leave with this. I know we've gone almost an hour, but I'm a bit of a sci-fi fan. And Rod Sterling, to me, was one of the best writers out there and a very great thinker. And one of the Twilight Zones that I watched as a kid was that the entire planet had to tell the truth to each other for one full day. And at that time, it closed out like Rod Sterling often did, and it showed Kennedy and Khrushchev. And, of course, this mandate had taken place where you could only speak the truth. And I thought, how interesting to think about. You know, it's a concept that, you know, is far from something taken to heart at the political class, which is unfortunately because these people are not leaders anymore. They're rulers. They're ruling over us. And that's a very unfortunate state of affairs. And that's part of the problem as well as many others. But it's something that we need to have the ability to stand up and talk about. And, you know, we do. So off on another topic, but Chris, it's been a true pleasure. I am honored that you're taking the time to come here. I think we're both heartfelt men that, you know, we are willing to give of our time, our most important commodity, to others to help them help themselves.
Well, thank you for that, and well said. So we will, of course, be posting the links where people can just directly click through to register and find out more. But for people who might be listening in the car, excuse me, or finding this on YouTube or through another channel, where can people register for the Las Vegas Solutions Conference?
It's that simple. Solutionsconference.us. So it's solutions conference, doesn't matter if it's capitalized or not, .us. So solutionsconference.us, and Vegas for the warmth and the affordability and ease of in and out. I mean, it works well. Certainly, I like your comment on Sin City, but it's a very easy place for almost anybody to get to, and it's warm that time of year.
Great. And for people who want to follow you more closely and maybe sign up for your newsletter.
TheMorganReport.com. Just go to TheMorganReport.com. We have a free report on a possible breakthrough technology in the junior space only. We tell you everything about this new technology without giving you the symbol. So you can kind of have a free look and say, geez, that's a speculation I'm interested in. You could sign up for the full paid report or not. So we're giving you like everything you'd want to know about this new technology without giving you the, you know, how to call your broker on it. So that's something that may be of interest to some of the listeners.
Fantastic. I'm sure it is. Well, David, thank you so much for your time. We didn't get to a number of topics. We'll have to get to those at some other point. And can't wait to do that. And I can't wait to see you in February.
My pleasure. Thank you, Chris.